Did you know that 70% of all books, including those traditionally published, are sold online via e-commerce? If you're an author wondering how you can get some of that market share, this is for you. Hi, I'm your co-host, Carly Waters, and I'm here to tell you how writers can work on their author brand and build an audience and convert those followers into book buyers. Ever wonder why so many authors publish books and later say that they didn't sell as many copies as they wanted? It happens over and over, and we see it all over social media. Authors think it's a them problem, but not always. They just weren't shown the way. And I don't want you guys to launch a book and show up at book events and have two people in the chairs. I've helped clients launch client books to the bestseller list for 15 years and have built a six-module, 11-hour course with all of my knowledge that will give you the craft and book business information that you simply won't find anywhere else. And there's an app plus monthly Q&A sessions with me. 200 of you have already joined my new course. And as writer Siobhan Moore said, I'm halfway through the course and grieving that I didn't have this information sooner. There's really nowhere else to find it. Worth every penny. If you want the info that will change the course of your writing career, go to carlywaters.com/course to learn more and use discount code POD15. That's POD15 at checkout. That's POD15 at checkout over at carlywaters.com/course. I'll see you there.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a three-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it. All examples, all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is the New York Times bestselling author of the Reese's Book Club pick, Lucky, currently in development for television, as well as the international bestsellers Mating for Life, Things to Do When It's Raining, and The Last Resort. She lives in Toronto, Canada, and today we are talking about her latest novel, The Lightning Bottles. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Marissa Stapley. Marissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bianca. It's always so great to chat with you.
Yeah, it should be welcome back to the show because you are a podcast favorite. We love having you on. Thank you so much to you for returning to chat to us about this book. So for our listeners, before we dive in, I'm going to read you the flap copy. So Jane Pyre was once half of one of the most famous rock duos in the world, the Lightning Bottles, alongside her soulmate, Elijah Hart. The Lightning Bottles emerged from the Seattle grunge scene in the early 90s and took the world by storm, and then everything came tumbling down. Elijah vanished at the height of the band's fame, and in the ensuing 5 years, Jane became the most hated and least understood woman in music. In a last-ditch attempt to get away from it all, the fans, the tabloids, her heartbreak, Jane decides to rent a house in remote Germany. But when her new teenage neighbor turns out to be a Lightning Bottles super fan, claiming to have information that might solve the mystery of what happened to Elijah, Jane realizes she can't leave her past behind. The unlikely pair embark on a road trip around Europe, chasing clues in the cities where, before everything went wrong, the Lightning Bottles played to teeming crowds of adoring fans and were at their happiest. The story of two misunderstood outsiders brought together by their shared passion for music, interwoven with flashbacks to Jane and Elijah's love story and their rise to fame during the grunge era, the Lightning Bottles is a poignant and gritty love letter to music, and a searing look at what happens when the stars we idolize come crashing back to earth. So, Marissa, just so much to love with this book. And the thing that really stood out to me is that, you know, this has been a book of your heart for a long time. I recall you talking about the story a long, long time ago. Now, I know when you wrote Lucky, that was an especially poignant book to you because of what you were going through then with your mother, but this book, can you tell us a bit about the genesis of it, when you conceived of it, how you conceived of it, and how we got you.
Yeah, so now I think it must have been 6 years ago at least. I feel like music is such a big part of my life. I think we can all say that. But when I was growing up in a small town and I was a grunge-loving teen and I had two other friends and we were the only people in the whole school who, you know, listened to alternative music. And then my brother had a band and I would be his roadie. And I just got so into it. And it was really my way of expressing myself. So I think in a way it was kind of born then, that sort of the love of the fact that I realized we were in this musical movement. The alternative grunge movement was so important, but it also had a very tragic ending. I mean, it really did all come crashing down around the time Kurt Cobain took his own life. And it really stuck with me. I mean, I was 14. I remember I was very affected by that cultural moment. And then I remember just knowing, like being in interviews and or talking to other authors and, you know, what would you write if you could write anything? And I'd always think to myself, oh my gosh, something set in the 90s, something in this scene. So that's where it's just always been a dream. And it actually was such a difficult book to write, perhaps because of that, also because of the complexity of realizing as I researched more and more about what happened to some of the pivotal people in the 90s scene, how difficult and dark it really was. Fame is a curse. This is what I've learned, you know, and it comes hand in hand often with addiction, mental health issues, all of that. So I think it needed all of that time. I started it and it was all epistolary. It was all letters and magazine articles. And I wrote almost maybe, let's say, a half draft with just all of this, realizing kind of as I went that it wasn't really a book. It was just me writing this backstory and almost writing a Bible for these characters. And then it was only, you know, after coming up with the idea for Lucky and choosing that idea instead and still living with this one, I think that I was able to figure out that actually the only way to survive fame is to disappear. For some. I think Kurt Cobain would still be alive if he'd gone off into, you know, Alaska for a few years and come back out again. So I kind of became obsessed with that. And that's where it came from. But it's not really Elijah's story. It really is Jane's story. And I think that is sort of the final piece, realizing that the legacy of the grunge and alternative scene is men, male artists. And that really ticks me off. And I wanted to tell a different version.
Yeah. Well, we'll get onto that shortly. But what I loved as well about what you said is how you started that. It was the epistolary form. It was articles, etc. But that kind of became the Bible for the version that it is now. And I think so many emerging authors at the moment, this is the sense I'm getting, that they're in such a rush to just write the book. And they want to get it in front of the agent. And they want to get it in front of the editor. And they want to get it published. But they forget that sometimes the most beautiful part of writing a book, the most beautiful part of creating something, is that whole process. It's that, I don't know what the hell this is. Is it an epistolary form? You know, am I writing articles? What the hell am I doing? But I'm getting it on the page because I'm getting to know these characters and I'm getting in their heads and I'm getting to understand the world in which they are operating. And then you put that aside and then you write Lucky and then you come back to it and you're like, okay, this is not actually what I wanted, but now I do know what I wanted. And all of that can feel like such a time waste. It's like, you know, some people will go, well, that was 6 years of wasted time, but it absolutely wasn't. Can you discuss that a bit?
Oh gosh, I can relate to that so much. Way back to the beginning of my career, and I'm sure there are many emerging writers who will relate to me when I say it's very difficult not to start telling people. You know, you're writing a book, and as soon as you start telling people, it's great because you're sharing this dream and talking about it, but also you start to feel the ticking clock because people will say, hey, how's your book going? You know, and they think they're asking you a nice question, but you just are like, oh my God, it's not going, or it's like a whole bunch of letters. It's not really a book. And it gets challenging. And I have been there. I mean, I rushed my first two, by the way, unpublished novels because of that, right? Because I just wanted to get them done. And I thought that was so important. And you're so right that the joy is in the moments of learning who your characters are and learning what the story is. And there are some books that just need that time. And I taught writing for a few years, and I would always say to my students, some of whom could be listening now, no writing is ever wasted. I would just try to drill that into their heads. Like, it's not a waste. Even an entire draft of getting to know your book is not a waste. It's you doing your, 10,000 hours, although I think it's probably like much more than 10,000 hours for becoming an author, or 10,000 hours per book or something. You know, it's an important part of the work. And if you can accept that, you'll feel better in your heart about this journey you're on towards hopefully publication.
Yeah. And it's so funny you say that the two books you rushed are still unpublished. And I remember the two books that I rushed when I was like, I just want to get this published. I'm not going to get beta readers. I'm not going to get any eyes on this. This book is great. I'm sending it off to an agent. Those are also unpublished. And thank God they're unpublished, because they were crap. They were really, really crap. So yeah, for our listeners, slow down. You came to writing because you love writing. And this is the only part of the whole process you have control over. Once you get that agent, once you get the editor, so much is out of your control. So enjoy all the moments that are in your control. Now, yes. Marissa, when I was reading this, I was getting such huge Courtney Love vibes, Kurt Cobain vibes. I enjoyed some of the grunge scene. I wasn't into all of it, but I was kind of obsessed with Kurt Cobain, Courtney Love. And then when I read the beginning of the book, so you do have a dear reader letter. I don't suppose you have a copy with you there, do you?
Sadly, no. People keep coming here and stealing. Every single person who comes here takes the copies. So
people are smart. They're right? Smart. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So I'm not going to read the whole one, but you go through, I was 12 in 1990 when I attended my first concert, which was Sinead O'Connor at the CNE Grandstand in Toronto. And you go on to discuss that. Can you discuss a bit about creating Jane Pyre? You mention other female artists, and you say that they were footnotes in the whole grunge scene. So Shirley Manson, Tori Amos, Fiona Apple, Liz Phair, Dolores O'Riordan, PJ Harvey. Can you take us a bit through them and perhaps how this book ended up being a love letter to all of these so-called footnotes?
Yeah, so I think that back then, these female artists felt like they were surrounding me. I mean, I came out of the gate, Sinead O'Connor, I was completely obsessed, 12 years old. I didn't really understand what happened to her until now, until a few years ago when her memoir came out in the documentary. And I know she'd ripped up the picture of the Pope, but I kind of just thought after that she maybe didn't, make very much more music. But that's not true. She was completely vilified and, pushed to the sidelines. Looking at Courtney Love, I kind of started believing that narrative. She's problematic for a few reasons that haven't fully been resolved, but she has always behaved like a rock star. And there are so many male rock stars who do things that she's done and worse, and they get their redemption arc, right? And it was so, so, so frustrating for me also to see who's memorialized, how they're memorialized, who makes the list of best of. And it just became more and more important for me to lift up these women who were the best. I mean, yes, there were great bands with men, great male singers, but there were some incredible artists. PJ Harvey's an incredible artist. Liz Phair, is always talked about how she was hot. She's this, she's that. Some of her lyrics are sexy. Fiona Apple's potential anorexia was always analyzed. She was singing about a very violent sexual assault that happened to her as a young girl. Like Tori Amos as well. All of these women were singing about really difficult stuff. And then treated in a way that I don't think I really fully externally understood, but I internalized. So it became really important to me. And I didn't want to be preachy, and I didn't want to be as mad as I actually got, because there were moments where I'd be like, I can't believe. Like I read Anthony Kiedis's bio, Scar Tissue, and there's bragging about statutory rape. There's some horrendous admissions that are just very casual, and he's getting a biopic. Like it makes me very angry. So I tried to work that out on the page, but I also think it's just important for people to know. And I want to keep talking about that as I talk about the book. It wasn't just Alice in Chains. It wasn't just Nirvana. It wasn't just Pearl Jam.
Yeah. I love how as well in the book, you also pay tribute to the fans. It's not just a love letter to these women. It's a love letter to the fans. So our other character in this book who has a POV is Hen. Now, was she always going to be a POV character? Was it a case of, you know, originally you just started with Jane and that's who it was going to be? Or was it very clear in your mind that we were going to have the super fan and we were going to have Jane and that the two stories would alternate?
Yeah, it was not clear at all. There were so many versions. In an original version, they had a child. His name was Hud, which is funny because then Taylor Jenkins Reid had a character named Hud. And I was like, wow, this, like, you know, we're all big magic. He was going to be the perspective. Just there were so many different versions that I honestly almost can't remember when Hen came along. I think it was just that little teenage version of me was kind of sitting on my shoulder the whole time, like, hey, hey, hello. But then in terms of her POV, she really only gets that prologue. And I went back and forth on whether to give her her own chapters. Same with Elijah. With Hen, I think I ruled it out partly because, as we all know, and this is a little emerging writer tip, it can get a little challenging when you have a character who is a teenager or a child. For publishers, they might say, well, we don't know if this is YA. And that, I've heard that before. I have friends who've had that. So Hen could really only have that prologue. And that was probably the single most difficult thing I've ever written in my entire life, because there was so much that needed to be packed in. Plus, there was a slightly unbelievable situation of, you know, Jane Pyre rolling up next door, which I've had things happen to me in my life where I'm like, this is such a, you know, this feels like fate or it feels like destiny, it's kismet. But, you know, when you tell the story, it sounds like you've made it up. So I had to do a bajillion drafts of that. But her presence in the story was really, really important because that is part of fame, right? Obviously, there is no fame without fans. And it goes back to, you know, the way I felt. Like I would dream, back to Sinead O'Connor, I would dream about her. I wanted to be her best friend. And even as I was writing The Lightning Bottles, I wanted her to read it. Like I would think, I can't wait. I'm going to figure out a way to get it into her hands. I was so personally heartbroken when she passed away because of that, because I was writing to her. And that is, there's this beauty in fandom, right? As long as you can kind of keep your shit together and not, you know, veer into stalkerdom. It's this love, but also it's a love of someone you don't know. And that's a huge part of the story too, is that Hen had to really get to know both Jane and Elijah. They're just people. We're all just humans.
Coming back to that prologue, because you know, we often on the podcast look at query letters and we look at prologues, and 9 times out of 10, we're like, this prologue does not belong here. It's not serving any purpose. It's a band-aid to fix your chapter one. And recently with my latest novel, I try to write a prologue from my character's perspective when she was like 8 years old. She's the main character, it has multi POVs, and I wanted to take us to the original inciting incident, like when she was 8 years old. And my editor was like, nope, 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 this sounds like YA. When you begin with a young character, it sounds like YA, even though it is your main character, but you're going back. And so my prologue became like chapter 18 in terms of a flashback. So when you did the prologue from Hen's perspective, one, it's unusual to have the prologue be from a completely different perspective. She is young. So were your editors happy with that? Was it a case of that's great? What I'm trying to ask is, how the hell did you do it, Marissa, that it didn't sound like YA and yet the rest of us are messing it up?
Okay, so I will say, sometimes I would see or listen to a podcast and you guys would be talking about prologues and I would think, oh no, maybe I don't need this. And I would actually try, probably because of you guys, to not do it. And my editor or agent would say, no, we need this. So like I had no choice. I think I'm going to go check after this. I think every one of my books has a prologue. So I love a prologue. But this one, as you said, it is so important. And I think if you're going to do one, maybe the secret is to work on it as hard as I did, because I probably worked on this prologue, you know, not as hard as the entire rest of the book, but it was so important. I didn't want to lose anybody to it feeling like YA or feeling like I wasn't telling the story properly. I'm so proud of it. I actually did have an incident where I was traveling. I was in Iceland, which is where there are some pivotal scenes in the book. And I had only brought my Kobo and I'd loaded the book onto it. And I was going to just read and process what it was looking like with just a notebook, no computer. And I was like, this prologue is like 80 pages. What the hell? Like, why is it so long? I must edit this down. And so I actually did somehow get myself on a computer and started editing it and realized it was because I had the font zoomed in like old lady font. It's so funny. I was freaking out. Like, I was texting my friends. I'm like, I can't go with you guys today. I have to stay back at the Airbnb and fix my book because my prologue is like so long. But that was probably a really good thing because I tightened it up so much because of that moment. And it just became the tightest thing. There were no wasted anything because I was terrified it was too long.
So then it became 40 old lady font pages.
Right. Oh my gosh. I even said to them, my editors have seen this. No one has said anything. Like, I was just spiraling that day. So, but I think the prologue benefited from that. And I think, yeah, writing is a funny thing, right? And books are funny. And I would say definitely very often a prologue is you just stalling, delaying, getting into the actual action. But in this case, the setup was just so complex and I needed it.
Yeah, so that's the bottom line, that when it comes to prologues, you need the intentionality of it and you need to come at it the right way. You know, with my book, I really felt that I really needed that to set up an inciting incident that happened sort of 20 years or 12 years before the story actually begins, but it didn't work. And so I was able to come up with something else. So there are different ways to come at it. But when you decide that the prologue is the way to do it, then you know you've hit on the right prologue if there's no other way to do it. Now, something we've been saying in our discussion, Marissa, is how tough this was at so many times of the process. And I don't know about you, but for me, writing gets harder and harder with each book I write. And I was not expecting this. I fully thought, okay, the first one's going to be tough, second one's going to be tough, but after that, I'm going to be a better writer and it's going to be easier. And I now find, I think there's this golfing term, it's called the yips. When you address the ball and you just swing back, and you actually can't hit the damn ball because you get the yips. And I'm finding I've got that now when I begin a book. I just can't dive in like I used to. Can you speak a bit about the challenges as you go along, and perhaps especially after having enormous success with a book like Lucky?
Yes. And I think it might be a baseball thing. Like, pitchers get the yips, maybe a golf thing too. But yeah, that's you're so right. Like, it's a real thing and they do get harder, and it is frustrating that that's the case. There were very, very dark, difficult moments with this book. Yes, in part because there is that expectation. I was able to somehow get that out of my head. People are waiting, or, you know, the New York Times success and everything that happened with Lucky, but it was more my own expectation. Like, this is the book. This is the book I've always wanted to write. Like, I have to land this. I have to land this. And there were times when I really struggled with that. And I think, you know, dealing with so many different factors, like, you know, the addiction and the fame and the fact that I always want my books to have that commercial element and be fun to read, you know, to be something that you're going to learn, it's going to teach you something, and it's going to be, you know, worthwhile and, you know, can stand up to, you know, literary discussions and book club discussions. But also, you throw it in your bag and take it on a holiday and you just can't put it down, right? You're completely entranced. And having these dark topics with something that I was trying to make commercial was very challenging. So I think that was where I would lose my way. And sometimes I would think, well, you know, maybe there's no drugs. Like, maybe we just don't have that. And my editors would say, well, no, he's definitely, you know, addicted to drugs. And we need to find a way to work this into the story where we're not getting completely bogged down. And so I read tons of addiction memoirs. And I think that was when I realized, like, oh my gosh, no one gets out of this. Like, it's so, so, so hard. So to guide my characters through an absolute minefield, it gave me the yips for sure. And I would think that if I could just, maybe I should be a barista, like that, I get to that point, you know, maybe I should be a flight attendant. Maybe I should, you know, run away, hide for 2 years. And it's so hard. And I feel that I realized I had done it. I'm sure you've had Carrie Clare on the podcast. She's a very astute reader and incredible reviewer. And she told me that there was a confidence in this novel that she felt in my debut. Like, it was debut level. It felt, and I just thought, okay, that is huge that I was able to get back to that place of, you know, that like starry-eyed confidence and feeling like you're doing something that is entirely new. I hope that every book can feel that way. You know, you just have to shut everything out. And I could shut everything out except for my own expectations of myself, but I think that's okay.
two things there is, yes, your first book, you do have this kind of confidence because you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, when I look back at things that I did in my debut, I'm like, that was insane. I don't know how I actually thought I could do that, but somehow I kind of did. And as you get older, you're like, oh, that's going to be hard to do. So maybe I don't do that. So yeah, it is trying to constantly get back to that point. And then shout out to Kerry Clare. So I know that she does occasionally take on manuscript evaluations. She books up very far in advance. So for those of you who do want an astute and excellent editor, look out for Kerry Clare on socials and maybe reach out and see when she is opening up her manuscript evaluations as well. Now, another question, Marissa, is I think on this book, you worked with two editors at the same time, your UK one and your US one, if I'm not mistaken. Could you take us through that process? Because I've never worked with more than just one editor at a time. And it fascinates me that some writers at some point actually work with two.
Three, actually. It was
three. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
So the UK editor did end up getting let go, as you know, this happens in the industry. So then it was only two. But then my Canadian editor, who's Nita Pronovo, otherwise known as Nita Prose, moved on to her author life. And I got another editor for the last kind of draft or two. However, it was an editor I have worked with previously on two novels, Brittany Laveri. So it all worked out. You know, it is something that I would not have been able to do with my debut or even my second novel, because even the process of being edited and learning what that conversation is, because it is a conversation, and then trying to have it with, you know, two, three people, somebody leaves, somebody else comes in, would be hugely challenging. I've been really lucky, I think, in that I've always had editors who've done this before. They've worked well together. There always is a leader, I think, somebody who kind of takes the reins, or somebody has a really great talent for line edit, somebody else's big picture. And I think good editors have those conversations away from you. And then they come to you and they're like, this is how we're going to do it. So I never had any too many cooks in the kitchen feeling. It was always just, okay, we've talked and now we're going to talk to you. We never had any moments where anybody was processing anything. I heard once, I don't know if this is true or not, that Margaret Atwood had like some editorial team, and the way they would do it is she would send the draft and then they'd all meet like and spend a night together in a hotel room talking about it, like a pajama party. And I was like, that sounds terrible. Like, I would not want to do that. Yeah. Margaret Atwood is, you know, she's got steel in her veins and everything. Maybe that's just what she wanted to do. But no, it wasn't like a editorial pajama party. It was, they were doing their thing. They would come to me. I never felt ganged up on. It was interesting to have all those brains, but we were always aligned.
Amazing. We're running out of time. I've got one last question, which I think a lot of our emerging authors would love to know, is there are so many times that you know something is not working and it feels like you know, trying to put puzzle pieces together that don't fit. And sometimes it's so frustrating because you're like, I know this isn't working, but I don't know how to fix it. And then later you'll get to the point where it kind of falls into place and you hear angels singing. It's mm-hmm. like, ah, you know, is there a way to force it to work? Is it a case of you just keep going at it? Is it sometimes the best thing that you can do is just completely step away from it and come back to it months later with all fresh eyes? Like, what's your advice there when people feel like things aren't clicking?
I mean, I think it's really impossible to truly walk away from something. And it can be, you know, the deadlines you've placed on yourself, the deadlines you actually have. But when I get that feeling like it's all just crashing down on my head and I've pulled the shelf down or whatever, I walk away from my computer. I have notebooks. I like to get bigger ones and I will go manual. So I will, you know, write down timelines manually and I'll write down what is not working and I'll write down different ways of approaching it by hand. And that is how I work it out. And it almost always works for me. I also feel like that moment when everything feels like a mess is that moment when maybe you're reorganizing your kitchen cupboards and you're just like, this is never, ever going to ever be the same again. What have I done? Like, and why do I have 10 boxes of cornflakes and there's ants everywhere? So, but that moment is the moment before you're able to start putting things on the shelf and getting rid of the things you don't need and sweeping things up. Like, so you can power through, But by the way, like, get your notebook, try things different, get organized, but also know that you're almost there when you're starting to feel like it's all disorganized. And it is often darkest before dawn. But if it stays dark, you might have a real problem. And then that's notebook time. It's calling in, you know, community time. It's maybe just going for a walk time.
Yeah, and I think it really helps working on something that you're super, super passionate about, because that'll keep bringing you back to the page, no matter how frustrated you are. Right, so this is the book, The Lightning Bottles. We're linking to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. Get it there. It is absolutely phenomenal. You will support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Marissa, we wish you all the best with this book, and then can't wait to have you back again.
Cannot wait. So nice to chat with you, Bianca.
Working in a creative industry, I've seen lots of writers and illustrators feel squeamish around money conversations. As a literary agent, I love talking about money, and that's why debunking money conversations are so important. Like, many people think you need loads of money to start investing, or they put off investing because it seems like a later problem. Or creators who deal with art and writing don't have time or passion to research and manage something like investments. That's why I'm thrilled that today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Growing up as a young girl who was told she wasn't good at math, investing definitely scared me, but I'm proud to say that I've overcome all those mindset concerns and love talking about investing and how money can be given a chance to grow over time with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/TSNOTYAW or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important information disclosures at acorns.com/TSNOTYAW.
Today's guest is a renowned journalist, author, and marketing consultant. As a top contributor to Forbes Woman, she shines the spotlight on those who have been historically underestimated, yet are doing the work to solve society's biggest problems. Her work has included interviews with a wide range of leaders, such as Senator Mazie Hirono, Tory Burch, Marie Kondo, Norma Kamali, and more. She also boasts a two-decade marketing career, working with some of the world's largest brands, from Procter & Gamble to Google. She now works with founders, corporations, nonprofits, and small businesses to shape their brand narratives and captivate audiences through strategic storytelling. After completing the setback cycle, she began working with organizations to help their employees and managers confidently lead through tumultuous times, offering the tools to help their teams navigate their own inevitable setbacks together. She graduated from the University of Maryland's Journalism School. Her children's book, A Magical Day in Sunnyside, is a tribute to the independent-owned businesses in her own beloved neighborhood of Sunnyside, Queens, where she lives with her husband and daughter. It's my pleasure to welcome Amy Schoenthal. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have you here because we don't discuss nonfiction nearly enough on the podcast. And we'll get people being like, Bianca, please, can we have some nonfiction? And so we do try and throw it in whenever we can. Our audience is predominantly fiction writers, but this is especially for those writing nonfiction. But also, we are going to be discussing a lot of things in this interview that apply to all authors, not just those writing in the nonfiction space. So if you are a fiction writer, don't think that this doesn't apply to you. Right, before Amy and I start chatting, I'm going to read the flap copy for the book that we're talking about, The Setback Cycle. How do you know if you're going through a setback? And once you realize you're in one, how do you work through it? Some of the world's most prominent leaders attribute their setbacks to the reason they found success. Their lowest moments paved the way for their creative rebirth. Through the four phases of the setback cycle, establish, embrace, explore, and emerge, Amy Schoenthal guides readers on how to make sense of their experiences, gain clarity on what comes next, and move confidently into future endeavors. That framework, developed through research and conversations with scholars, psychologists, neuroscientists, and executive coaches, is supported through the deeply personal stories of founders and leaders like fashion icons Stacey London and Norma Kamali. Fitness instructors Robin Arzone and Kendall Toole, Chef Palak Patel, non-binary beauty influencer Cyrus Vasey, and inspirational founders like Kate Luzio, Erica Taylor, Amanda Goetz, and more. Right, so whether you're stuck in a rut after a breakup or trying to navigate an unexpected professional transition, the Setback Cycle offers guidance on how to take yourself through your toughest moments and forge a stronger path forward. And guys, I know that there are so many of you right now who are listening to this who are going to want to rush out and buy this book, because writing is all about setbacks. The journey to publication is all about setbacks. And if you cannot overcome them as a writer, you will not see success in your own career. I can tell you that from personal experience. Can you speak a bit about that, Amy, before we dive into the rest of the interview?
Oh, absolutely. I think the journey to getting a book published, especially if you're going for a traditional book deal, that journey is rife with setbacks. And if you don't have the tools to navigate the rejection and the sort of self-doubt that creeps in throughout that process, it's going to be a really rough, rough go. And I know this from my friends who have gone through the process. And of course, I went through it myself as an author who was told many, many times, you don't have a big enough platform. You don't have enough social media followers. So happy to talk about that more if you'd like.
I love that you speak about tools, because that helps you feel like you're in control of a situation that you have very little control of. Once the book goes out there, you know, a lot of it is based on luck. Who knows who's going to pick up your book at the right time and want to read it or want to represent it. And all of that's out of your control. But dealing with setbacks, dealing with rejection, using those tools, that's all completely within your control. So I really love the word tools. And nothing makes me sadder when I interact with a really good writer, somebody whose work I believe needs to be out there, and I hear that they've given up on writing, on trying to get published, because they weren't able to navigate all of the rejection and all of the setbacks. So I believe every time a good writer gives up on writing, an angel loses their wings. So don't be the people out there who's making angels lose their wings. So Amy, something you said now, in terms of platform, a huge platform is something that I'd really like for us to discuss. So how do you get a book deal without having a huge platform? And how much rejection is associated with that?
I don't know that my answer is going to exactly apply to every single scenario. However, I will say that if you have the grit and tenacity and drive to write a book, you need to apply that same level of determination, of like a little bit of fearlessness, and of just putting one foot in front of the other and moving forward to really tell people, whether it's agents or editors or just the people at the coffee shop in your neighborhood, how much you truly believe in the book you are writing. You tell anyone who is willing to listen how much you believe in it, how much you think it will change the lives of readers, and why this book needs to be out there. If you apply the same level of hard work that you are applying to writing your book, to getting your book out into the world, I really, really, truly think you will be successful. And I think when you go through it, just in the same way you're struggling to write a chapter and it's not clicking, and you don't just walk away, you don't give up. You walk away maybe temporarily, but you come back and you figure it out. Maybe you go to someone else, you have someone else read it and give you feedback, but you figure it out and you keep moving forward. You apply that same formula to getting your book out there. I went through so many rounds of rejection. I had a whole book proposal that I went to a ton of agents and editors with, and I got rejected by all of them. But what I did was I took copious notes from every conversation I had, from every email I got back, and I noticed patterns in the feedback. And I said, okay, if everyone is saying this about the book, then I need to change this, or I need to figure out how to address the feedback that they're giving me. And that's what I did. And I went off for another 6 months and I changed the proposal. And I threaded, everyone told me I needed to thread the story together. At first, this book was like separate story, and it still a little bit is, but it felt very separate. Like all the different stories of founders felt like individual stories, and every agent and editor said I needed to tie it together more coherently, more cohesively. And that's exactly what I did for 6 months. And I went back out. I just did the same thing. I pitched agents and editors. And I had a few like really productive conversations with agents, but a lot of people were telling me to change things that I didn't want to change. And a lot of people were telling me I needed to go out and, you know, basically like buy social media followers and build my platform. And I refused to do that. I said, first of all, a bunch of bots are not going to buy books. So this is just like vanity metrics that are going to get me a book deal and then set me up for disappointment, because they're going to think, oh, you have, you know, 30,000 social media followers. Great. We're going to sell 20,000 books. But if it's all bots, like those numbers are meaningless. So I ignored that advice. But, I took other advice that I thought was helpful. And then finally, I found an agent who saw the proposal and she believed in it as much as I did. She said, this book is going to change people's lives. Now that I see the setback cycle and understand it, you know, and this was only in proposal form, she said, I'm seeing it everywhere. I just can't stop seeing it. And I was like, this is the agent that's going to get me the book deal. And sure enough, she did.
I love so much of what you've said there. It just takes one yes. I say that over and over, and it really does. Just one person who believes in what you're doing and champions it and is as passionate about it as you are makes the world of difference. So that's why it's important to keep going, because you don't know if that one yes is the next person who you're pitching to. To learning from rejection. You know, it doesn't help to say, well, I'm going to get 100 rejections and just keep doing the same thing over and over and hope for my one yes. You need to be leveraging the feedback that you're getting, however small. Look for those consistencies, change the work accordingly. That is really essential. Something that I want to speak to, Amy, is how you say that you need to tell everyone how much you believe in this work. And, you know, when I first came to Canada, it's something I really struggled with, because culturally, not all cultures are the same as the American culture in terms of be your biggest cheerleader, blow your own horn. You know, in South Africa, it's actually considered very bad form to tell everyone how fabulous something is that you've worked on. It's considered bragging. It's considered really taboo. And so that was something I had to get my head around. And I had to realize when I was talking about my work, because I'm able to brag about my best friends. Anyone I know, I will scream their praises from the rooftop and tell everyone how awesome they are. I can't tell people that I'm awesome. But I was like, this book is not me. It's something that I've worked on. It's something I really believe in. And so I need to view this book as my best friend so that I can scream about it from the rooftops. So can you speak a bit about that as well? Like for those of the listeners who it doesn't come naturally to them, were they able to just do this?
First of all, in America, especially I think as a woman, we are not conditioned to scream from the rooftops about how great we are at all. That is something I want to say I struggled with. And yes, I didn't go around saying like, I, Amy Schoenthal, am awesome. And again, I think it is easier when you have like a body of work to talk about versus talking about yourself as a human. Like I wasn't going around saying I am a really talented writer. I don't think I would ever say that. Like I will never gain the level of comfort to say that.
Can you imagine if we had business cards that we just handed out that says Amy Schoenthal, excellent writer, the right? Best. Right? Top of the game.
But I will say, and this is advice I got from someone who is in the book, Kate Luzio, who's the founder of Luminary. And she always says, don't go around saying that you're awesome. Just build your business case. State facts that back up the argument that you're awesome. So when I was going around either, you know, trying to get the book deal, or even once the book came out, trying to get people to buy it, I would just list things about the book. I would say things about the book. Setbacks are a universal human experience. And I interviewed really credible experts and scientists and, you know, famous entrepreneurs and business leaders to get their thoughts on setbacks. And I compiled it into the book. Don't you want to read it? You know what I mean? Like, you just list facts. Once the book hit the USA Today bestseller list a couple of times, like USA Today bestselling book, The Setback Cycle, is everywhere in all my communication. And I even say it when I'm talking about it. And I'll say it in a way that's, it's not fake humble. It's actually true. I will say I was shocked that my book hit the bestseller list, not just in week one, but a couple weeks in a row. And I'll share that as part of my experience. But at the same time, I'm stating facts that build my business case and build the argument that this is probably a good book and you should probably read it because you are a human who will have setbacks. Enough people read this book and bought this book that it reached this bestseller status, right? Even before it got to that point, you know, there were things. I interviewed a neuroscientist and here's what she had to say, like dripping out little pieces of the book that will form the argument that you as a person should buy it and read it. You as a person, as an agent, should represent me. You as an editor should, you know, give me a book deal. Whatever, whoever you're making the argument to, just lead with the facts and lead with the, I would say lead with the impact of your story more than the story. Not, oh, I interviewed these, you know, 15 people and their stories are in the book. No, no, no. You as a reader will encounter setbacks and I have the tools and inspiration for you to get through it.
I love all of that and I'm hugely inspired by all of that. I'm going to keep reminding myself of that. Because like you say, American women don't do that with themselves, but they still come across as so much more confident than we are in other cultures. And I think for you, when you see people facing setbacks and you're like, I have the answers, it's in this little book, I can help you, I want to help you, makes it so much easier as well. And for our listeners out there, when you see a gap in the market for your book, whether you know it's going to resonate with a certain kind of people, or a certain kind of person, that certainly helps you champion it as well. So bring Amy's passion to it. I absolutely love it. So in terms of landing on the idea of setbacks, can you take us through that and a bit more about the research process in terms of gathering all the information for writing this book?
Of course. The research process really wasn't, I think all I did was I read a ton of business psychology books because I was searching for answers to what I was seeing. And I hadn't landed on the concept of setbacks yet. I thought, okay, I'm seeing that there's this pattern in every story, every time I interview a founder or a business leader, I'm seeing this pattern, this story, and almost like a formula that is consistent across everyone, whether it's a fashion designer or a fitness instructor or a corporate executive. And why is it following such a similar trajectory? But it doesn't necessarily fall into any of the categories that society understands. Like there's a lot about, you know, learning from failure or learning from your mistakes or post-traumatic growth. But a setback is not always a failure, and it's not always born from a mistake you made. You know, a setback could be something that's like wildly out of your control and you still have to deal with it. A setback is not always a trauma or a big dramatic event. There's plenty of smaller micro everyday setbacks that lead you to a place where you have to work through the setback cycle and you get somewhere better than the original path you were on. And I couldn't find a term to assign to this. I wanted to understand it and I couldn't find it anywhere. So I started reading books. I started reading books about uncertainty and change and growth, personal growth, you know, and I found little hints of it like here and there, but no one had really explored the concept of setbacks in a meaningful way. So once I came across the definition of a setback, which is a reversal or check in progress, I was like, oh, that's it. Because that term encompasses all the big dramatic setbacks, all the failure, all the learning from our mistakes, but it also nods to just the everyday setbacks where, yeah, you find a reversal in progress and you have to work your way back or you have to work your way elsewhere. And so that, when I came upon the definition of a setback, I said, okay, that's it. It's a setback and they go through a cycle. How do I figure out how to help them through that cycle? So once I had my hypothesis, which again came through very simple research, and I call it research, but it was really just reading books that were out there. Then I went on a real journey of many, many months of interviewing experts. I said, okay, if I have this hypothesis, I need to test it in the world. I need to ask experts to input on whether or not this works. You know, does the setback cycle work? I think I had 5 phases at first. Then we went down to 3 phases. You know what I mean? So I was workshopping this theory, this framework for a long time before it ever became the 4-phase setback cycle that you know now. So the research really went from collecting information. I was also reading like academic papers and, you know, I would go read articles and then click to the sources and like really go in deep. I had like pages and pages of like crazy, crazy, crazy research notes. And then really going and having conversations and validating the hypothesis that I had gleaned from all this research with experts in their field. And it's those experts who I quote in the book who really helped me come up with the framework.
I love that. A question there, when dealing with these experts, when interviewing them, getting their feedback, et cetera, is this something you have to pay for? Is it something that you interview them and therefore you are giving them a platform when you speak about the work and when you publish the work? For those who are interested in interviewing experts, what does that process look like?
For me, I really just reached out to them. Like I would reach out, I would send emails, I would submit, you know, contact forms, things like that. And look, some of them got back to me, some didn't. But I would ask friends, like, do you have a good executive coach I could interview? You know, I worked with an executive coach at the marketing firm where I worked. I interviewed her. I said, you know what? You're great. I would like to interview you for the book I'm working on. You know what I mean? So it was professionals who I was connected to in some way, recommendations from other folks. And then I remember listening to a podcast. I was listening to Adam Grant's podcast, and he interviewed a neuroscientist, and I really loved what she had to say. And so I reached out to her, like blind contact form. And I said, hey, I'm a writer. I'm working on this book. I'd love to get your thoughts. And her name is Chantel Pratt. She was so generous with her time. I interviewed her several times and I said, you know, what can I do in return? Is there anything I can do to support your work? She was like, no, just like keep doing your work, which in turn, you know, connects people to me. And she has a book, The Neuroscience of You. And so she was like, if you talk about me in podcasts and talk about the book, that, you know, that's great. And so I think that writers generally want to support each other. And so when people I reached out to were also authors, they kind of understood the path that I was on and were willing to help. And yes, some were too busy and couldn't get back to me. And that's okay. There are plenty of experts in this world and you will find one if you need one.
Yeah, I love good literary citizenship. Always try and be a good literary citizen. And so many people are so generous. You know, I find that the people who are the busiest, who have the most knowledge, are generally the ones who will make time for you and who will speak to you and generously share with you. And the people who kind of hoard that and are always too busy, well, that's a different kind of person. Right, we have very little time left, Amy, and there's a whole bunch of things I still want to pick your brain about. So can you quickly take us through how you were able to come up with the 4 phases of the setback cycle? And then I want to move into marketing strategies, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course. I'll do the 4 phases fairly quickly. So there's 4 phases: establish, embrace, explore, and emerge. Establish. So like I said, we had originally started with 5 phases. Then we kind of went down to 3. And when I say we, it's me, my agent, my editor, you know, all the people who kind of weighed in on this book. But then it was through talking to these experts that I ended up creating the 4 phases as you know them today. And so establish as phase 1, that was not in the cycle until like close to the end, because what I realized was before you get to embrace, which is the part of the setback cycle where you just have to digest the information and deal with it and use it to guide your path forward, you might first have to establish that you're in a setback, because so many people unconsciously just float along and move forward by inertia and they don't even realize that they're like working their way into a setback. Or they're ignoring it because they don't want to deal with the discomfort or the energy of getting themselves out of it. So establish really kind of, I think it was part of embrace, but then it kind of took on a life of its own and it became this very important step before you even get into working through the cycle, just to establish that you're in a setback. And there were all these tools coming up. So eventually, again, you start writing a book and it takes shape. You know, you have this idea of what it's going to look like, but then it takes shape as you research and write and talk to people. And so Establish was really born kind of at the end because it felt like it needed its own phase. And that became phase one.
I love that it came near the end, because that's so much like fiction. You know, there'll be a book that you work through and you get to the end and you know something isn't working. You can't quite figure out what it is that isn't working. And then you'll tweak one thing and you have to go back. And once you've figured out what that thing is, everything else then falls into place. And yeah, you know, in terms of just when I think of the rejection we get as writers, you know, learning to embrace the feedback we get. Sometimes, you know, I'll do manuscript evaluations and people are expecting or hoping that I'm going to say this book is perfect. It's ready to go out on submission. And I'll be like, I hate to tell you this, but we have a big problem either with regards to structure or plot or whatever the case is. And you can just see it takes this beat for them to really be able to get to the point where they embrace the feedback and go, you know what, this is going to be a lot of work, but it's actually going to be worth it once I revise and fix this thing and it's going to make it more sellable. So writers, go out and get this book, because it applies to everything in your life, to writing, and I'm sure it'll apply to things in your career as well. So Amy, why is writing a book different from writing as a journalist? I speak to a lot of journalists, I speak to a lot of academics, and they always say that their writing hat is very different from their journalism or writing academia hats. Can you speak a bit about going backwards and forwards between those different styles?
Yes, this was actually a huge challenge for me because I am a formally trained journalist. Like, I went to journalism school and have been writing for 20 years as someone who is supposed to completely remove themselves and remove their opinion and point of view from an article. So as a journalist, you're trained to elevate the voices of others, share their arguments, present conflicting arguments, you know, present all sides of a story and, you know, package it in a way that allows the reader to make their own decision and form their own opinion. Now, when you're trained to pull yourself out of the story, and also I have a 20-year career in marketing where you're trained to do the same thing, because you're writing and you're creating content on behalf of brands, and you need to remove yourself from that. You need to write in the style of the brand that you are doing the marketing for. So as a journalist and as a marketer, I have like hid myself in a corner, which is what you need to do in order to do both of those crafts. Now, as an author, the biggest point of feedback I got from every editor, agent, you know, freelance editor, everyone who read my story was, where are you? Where is your point of view? Where is your voice? We need your voice in here. So training myself now, after again, like 20 years of removing myself from the narrative, putting myself back in and writing as my own person in my own voice, that was so hard. I was just not prepared for it. I was not prepared to do it. I thought the stars of this book are the leaders that I have written about and the experts who are giving you the advice and the tools that I've pulled together from a combination of the research and the interviews. This is what is going to make the book valuable for readers. But what ended up happening was I did end up putting my own story in there, and I wove in my own voice, and I shared a couple small anecdotes from my life throughout the book. It's in very small places, but you'll see it. And when you read it, know that it took so much for me to put that in there. What happened was, when I got to the marketing of the book, all anyone wanted to talk about was my setback story. I mean, my setback story is probably like 3 pages of a 200-page book. Like, it is just the small. That's all anyone wanted to talk about. You're the author. You talk about setbacks. You're the setback expert. Tell us about your biggest setback. And I got so much attention from press, from podcasters, from like, I mean, it was beyond my wildest expectations. And all they wanted to talk about was my setback story, which I had to be convinced to put in the book. So it just goes to show you, like, you know, take the advice, stand your ground when you feel that, you know, don't lose any integrity over it, but take the advice when it's meaningful, because you never know when it's going to really pay off.
Yeah. Something that I was very surprised by when I published my first book and I kept getting invited to book clubs to discuss it, I thought, okay, we're going to talk about the story and the plot and the characters. And without fail, every single book club pretty much that I've been to wants to talk about my experience of growing up, my experience of apartheid in South Africa, my response to it, my family's take on it, et cetera, et cetera. And very few people actually want to talk about the book itself. So this is something as writers that we need to prepare ourselves for. I thought it was just memoirists who would have to talk about themselves all the time.
Same. I never expected that I would be the center of this story. The story was not written about me. The book didn't, you know, come to fruition because of my own experience. It was because of the inspiration I had by talking to others. And yet, when it came time to talk about the book, like, people really, they want to hear from the person who wrote the book. So you do need to center yourself in the story. You do need to put your voice in there, and don't be afraid to really, really, you know, be vocal about your own experience and your own opinion.
Love that. Amy, we've got time for one more question, and I'm going to ask this. In terms of a book launch and a book tour, you know, I know when I published my debut in 2017, I got to go out on a pre-publication tour with two other authors. We went for a week, all different stops with the marketing people and salespeople and editors. I got to go on a book tour for the first book, tiny book tour for the second book. By the third book, it's over, man. You've got to fund it yourself. I was funding that entire tour myself. So you've done a lot. You've gotten out there. So can you speak a bit about budgeting for the launch and for the tour and what that looks like?
Unfortunately, I don't know if I'm going to have the most satisfying answer. So my publisher, yes, there was no marketing budget. Like, no one paid me to go anywhere. But what I did was I am a pretty frequent speaker at conferences, at corporate engagements. And once I had the book coming out, I pretty much went around to like all of my contacts. And I said, my book comes out in March. Can I come to your company? Like, can I speak on a panel? Can I sell books at the bookstore of this conference? And what I did was I created a book tour based on where I was being invited to speak. So I was speaking at, I also live in New York City, which helps because I was able to do a lot of events in New York City. My book launched in March, which was Women's History Month. And since so many of the people profiled in the book are women leaders, we really used that as an angle for press, for speaking engagements and things like that. So there's a lot of Women's Month events in March in New York City. And so I was able to sort of tack my message onto that, whether I was a panelist, a moderator, a speaker, or even if I was just an attendee and I asked, you know, can I put bookmarks in the gift bags? So I had a presence at a lot of events that were already happening. I did have a book launch party. That was just a fun activity I wanted to do to celebrate the fact that I wrote a freaking book. So that was just like a party for friends and colleagues and things like that. And it was just like so much fun. I had like a whole orange suit and like a glittery crop top. So I matched the book cover. Like, that was just like a fun celebration for me. So I had that, a lot of events in New York City, a lot of Women's History Month events and panels. And then in April, so this is a month after book launch, I went and I traveled around the country. But it turns out there were just a lot of speaking engagements that I had secured in the month of April. And so I had a conference in Nashville, Mom 2.0, which is this, you know, women entrepreneur moms running their own businesses. It's a conference for folks like that. And I spoke there. And so they had a bookstore on site at the conference and I sold the book there. While I was in Nashville, I went on the local Nashville, you know, news show. I spoke at a corporate engagement while I was there. Then I, you know, I went to LA and I stayed with friends and I spoke at an event and I did a bookstore event. So every time I had a speaking engagement, I would just kind of like build a whole book extravaganza around it. So I just made the most of places where I was already traveling. Then I was asked to do a TEDx talk in Washington, D.C. at the end of April. So that worked out really well because not only, you know, Washington, D.C., there's so many bookstores. And then I spoke at another event while I was in town. I went on the local, you know, Good Day Washington news show. And I just made the most of the places where I was already going. So there was no additional investment made on my part. I didn't really create a book tour itself. I just took the places I was already going and turned each travel, you know, location into its own opportunity for whatever marketing and events and publicity I could do in those markets.
Really, really smart to leverage all of those opportunities that were already available to you in terms of book sales. And for our listeners, you know, look at your own life, look at your own independent bookstores, look at your own industry and see ways that you can do that for yourself. Amy, I'm afraid our time is up. This has been absolutely fascinating. For our listeners, we're linking to the Setback Cycle on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore and you support the podcast at the same time. Amy, thank you so much for your incredible insights.
Thank you so much for having me. I love this podcast, so it was such an honor.
Today's guest is a creative writing and English literature graduate from Royal Holloway, University of London. She has a soft spot for writing unlikely, flawed, messy heroes and loves mixing humor and heartbreak. She is also passionate about bringing more LGBTQIA plus representation and fat positivity into fantasy. When not writing, she can be found sewing nerdy costumes for comic conventions or researching obscure historical facts. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome Frances White. Frances, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
It is so great to have you here. I can't remember when last I had so much fun reading a book. I was laughing out loud. It kept me guessing. It was hilarious. It was just so endearing. So before we dive into all of my questions here, I'm going to read the flap copy for our listeners. So the book we're discussing today is Voyage of the Damned. I mean, I'm holding up the cover here. Some of you might see this in a promo video, but it is just so beautiful. It is one of those gorgeous, gorgeous covers, gold foil, really stunning. And it's full of illustrations and maps. And it just, it's a kind of book that you just want to own. You want to have it for yourself. So go out and get it in hardcover now if you're one of the readers like I am that loves having beautiful books. So here we go. I'm going to read you the flap copy. 12 magical blessings, 12 days at sea, one chance to stop a killer and save the world. For 1,000 years, Concordia has maintained peace between its provinces. To mark this incredible feat, the Emperor's ship embarked upon a 12-day voyage to the sacred goddess's mountain. Aboard are the 12 heirs of the provinces of Concordia, each graced with a unique and secret magical ability known as a blessing, all except one. Ganymedes Pizarro, class clown, slacker, and all-round disappointment. When a beloved heir is murdered, everyone is a suspect. Stuck at sea and surrounded by powerful people, and without a blessing to protect him, Ganymedes' odds of survival are slim. But as the bodies pile higher, Ganymedes must become the hero he was not born to be. Can he unmask the killer and their secret blessing before this bloody crusade reaches the shores of Concordia? Or will the empire, as he knows it, fall? Dun, dun, dun. And at the back is this lovely quote. We can get murdered tomorrow. Tonight, we party. So much to love you, Frances. And I actually just want to read a tiny bit from your acknowledgements as we dive into this novel. This book is the sum of all the books that came before it, which now lie at rest in my book graveyard. Thank you, ill-fated stories, for your sacrifice. You walked and died slow deaths so Dee could run. So I would love to hear about these manuscripts and your journey to publication, because our listeners love hearing these success stories. So tell us all about it.
Do you want the long version or the short version?
I want the long version with every excruciating detail.
For selling them. So it took me 7-8 years from when I started querying to actually signing a book deal. So it's a long process. The first book that I wrote, I did write down the dates because I thought this is going to be relevant. So let me have a look. It was in 2015 I was querying it. And it was historical fiction. Way, way too many words. I think it was 260,000 words long. I just had no clue what I was doing. I sent it up and was like...
So for our listeners, almost just spat out my coffee when I heard that. So yes, carry on.
Yeah, that's too long. For our listeners, that's way too long. But I only queried it. I didn't really know what I was doing. It was just sort of dipping my toe into the water. It was my first ever book that I'd written, like, and finished it. So I only queried about 14 agents and obviously all rejections, apart from one which was personalized and gave me advice, which at the time I had no clue how great it was to get that. That's for what I'd sent. I'm surprised that they did that. But very grateful. Yeah, my next book was, it was an adult fantasy. So all the rest of them on were adult fantasies, which is the genre I wanted to get into. That one was a book that I'd been like planning on and off. I think every fantasy writer has these books that are the one you've been thinking about since you were a kid. And, you know, it's always been in your mind. So that was that book. I queried it in 2017 and I sent 36 queries. And I did quite well. I got 3 fulls and 2 partials, which from that many was quite good. But again, I had no clue that that was that good. All I saw was rejection. And it was a very long wait between. So for the full requests, I didn't hear from any of them until after a year. So I'd sort of like written it off in my mind. Yeah, and the rejections that I got, one of them after a year and me chasing, like, you know, after 6 months, then 8 months, they just said a reply that was 2 words. And it was, sorry, no.
Okay, you know what? I'm kind of speechless at that because, you know, we've got 2 agents who are co-hosts on the podcast, and I see it from both sides. As a writer who queried and had to wait forever for these rejections and who was like, just give me some feedback I can use as opposed to the form rejection. You know, I know what it's like to be a writer waiting. And I know as well from the agents, I see how many queries they get and I see how difficult it is for them to keep up with that. But sorry, no. Frances, please tell me you have since emailed this agent and been like, biatch, look at what I am doing. Please tell me you are that petty. Please, please.
I'm not that petty. And also, I don't think they're an agent anymore. So maybe it wasn't fully for them. So that would perhaps explain.
I'd still hunt them down, even if they're not an agent, and send them like balloons of the cover of my book and how well it's done, just to be like, big mistake, huge.
Oh, gosh. But yeah, while I was querying that, I started writing another one, as is the best advice, which I still stand by, to write something else. And the book I was writing then was, I call it the book that like querying wrote, because it was everything that I was told you needed to put in a book for it to be successful. I was trying to funnel it into that book, but I was really confident in it. That was like the book I was most confident in, which is ironic because it crashed and burned. It didn't do well at all. I queried it the most. I sent 70 emails in 2019 and I didn't get any fulls at all. I just got 2 partial requests, so it really didn't do well. That was the lowest I've been after querying that, because obviously you hear a lot of querying stories, and in those stories usually the request rate goes up and people improve of each book, but I felt like I was going down and down and down.
Can I ask, what were the elements you thought people were looking for that you then tried to put into this book?
At the time, that was when in fantasy, which is the opposite of now, but it was when like grimdark was big. So it was like dark and gritty. And I tried to put like a sort of catchy pitch, you know, sort of the tension one line grabber. But everyone always said, oh, you've got to start with action. And I started with a fight scene. And now I realize that was really bad. That was probably what was the nail in the coffin for it. Because actually it's not a good idea unless you've got the context for a fight scene. So yeah.
Okay, and then when was Voyage of the Damned born?
We're almost there. The 4th book that I queried was not Voyage of the Damned. It was, again, I also think this was a querying written book where I was sort of trying to nail down particular things. I was listening to too many voices, but I did sign my agent with it. I still think it's a good book. I sent 80 queries and I got 8 full requests. So that was pretty good.
And that book went out on submission and it just didn't get taken?
Yeah.
Oh, God, that must have been heartbreaking because you go, I finally have the agent, right?
Yeah.
This is it. This is going
to
happen.
Yeah, it took like 6-7 years to get the agent. And so I was sort of like, well, this is the book then. This is the one. This must be the one. And then it didn't. Unfortunately, it sort of died on sub. But when it was on sub is when I was writing Voyage of the Damned. When it was dying... I was writing Voyage of the Damned, which was definitely a response to me going through all that and slowly losing my will a little bit. So I kind of like lost my love. I felt myself losing my love for writing because I was trying to focus so much on the success or getting to a particular point that I was like, I need to take it back to why I started writing in the first place. So that's what Voyage of the Damned was. It wasn't thinking about what the publishers are looking for, or I mean, it is a bit of a weird genre blend, which was not in fashion at all at the time, but I kind of indulged myself with it. I just wrote it for me and enjoyed myself, so it sort of reignited that love. And yeah, that went on submission and sold after about, I think it was about 4 months, which is pretty quick nowadays.
Yeah. And I mean, I would have expected there to be a bidding war for this. I would have thought there'd be more than one person who wanted this. Is that what happened, or it sold to one publisher who wanted it?
There was two. So I think that counts as an auction. I'm not sure. But there was two and they were told to bid the highest. So yeah, I'm gonna say it sold at auction.
We will take that as an auction story. There is so much to love here. One, I love the tenacity. You have paid your damn dues. You have paid them and you've just kept going. And what I love is that it was the book that you had fun with, because it's there on every page of this book, Frances, how much fun you had with this book. I could see it. I could feel it. It crackled through the pages. And there's something to be said for a book that you write, that you do it for you because you love it and you love these characters, as opposed to you're trying to tick boxes for publishers, right?
Yeah, it was definitely for me. And I think that's why when it did sell, I was like, I mean, I wasn't glad that it took 7 or 8 years, but in a way I was so glad it was this book and not the other books. So I was like, this book is so authentically me. It's a good statement of like the kind of author I am and what you can expect in future. So yeah, I was really glad it was this one that sold.
Can we talk, what happened with TikTok? Because there's talk of a TikTok sort of sensation around this book. What happened there and how did that help the book?
I think that was helped in a lot because it was chosen for Illumicrate, which is a fantasy box subscription, which has a lot of subscribers and they all share their unboxings. So that was a good way to get everyone talking about it. And also the fandom around it have been really, people who get the book just seem to absolutely love the book. So I've got like fan art, people have done some cosplays, fans have made little figures of the characters and given to me. So I think there's like a good fandom feeling around it, which is nice.
That's incredible, because I know that the North American version came out quite a few months after the UK version. And so that must have been linked to the success from that subscription box and TikTok. Is that right?
I think to a degree. So we did like go out simultaneously on sub in the US and we did in the UK, but it was rejected en masse by everybody. Then my UK publisher got the US rights with the initial deal and they tried to sell it to the US. And they didn't want it again, so it went twice. And then it was only after it was already out in the UK for a while and it fell into the right hands, and a very enthusiastic person, one publisher who I owe a lot to, really fought for it and was like, we need this book. And they agreed, and yeah, Mira bought it and put it out. So it is thanks to sort of the fandom around it and everyone being so enthusiastic that it got into the right hands, I think.
I love that. Okay, so I want to dive into the world building here because it was just phenomenal. So for our listeners, you know, we say that when it comes to world building and backstory, right, it needs to kind of be like an iceberg. What you see in the book is the tip of the iceberg, but what's below is everything that the author knows about this world, and they know about the backstory, and they know what happened 1,000 freaking years ago to get the world to the point where it is now. And in this book, so in terms of the Empire of Concordia, we've got 12 different provinces. Each of the provinces looks very different. You know, their topography is different. Their industry is different. Their cultures and the kind of illegal languages that they're not really supposed to speak, but they do speak, is so different. And each person, you know, you've got one representative from each of these provinces who has a blessing, who's a specific kind of person. And we see the tip of the iceberg in the book. Like, we understand what each place looks like and we understand their industry and we get some of the backstory in terms of how it happened that the whole empire came together. But Frances, take me through this in terms of how much work it was to figure that all out before you began writing. Or was it like, I'm just diving in, and then you were like, oh shit, I've got to figure out what the provinces all do? Like, what did that look like? And you drew like a sigil that represents that province. And I know that they then, somebody else took your original drawings and then they drew this incredible map and a map of the ship that they all go on. Take me through all of that, because I'm geeking out on that.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I would say as a writer, world building is my least favorite of the three main things, character, plot, and world building. I'd put it third, but obviously there was a lot I had to do for this. So I was focusing on the plot first. So I would say my first draft had minimal world building when I first went in. I wanted to make sure I nailed the plot, especially with the murder mystery. There's so many moving pieces. I didn't really want to get distracted. I wanted to make sure the world building that was going in the book was serving the plot, because it would have become overwhelming, I think, if there was too much of that alongside everything you need to know about a murder mystery and all the elements that go into that. But once I had written that and nailed that, I took the provinces one by one and I basically, went through and developed them. A lot of them were originally, and I think you can still tell, is some of them based on real world places, because I wanted to make sure that they would be vaguely recognisable to people, because I know that in the book we don't really visit any of them. We're briefly there in chapter one, but it really is brief. So I wanted to make it easily recognisable to readers, and especially anyone who's coming in who's not used to fantasy. And obviously with an empire, I wanted it to feel as vast and as varied as possible. So I wanted them all to be very distinctly different. So that helps not only with being able to tell them apart if you're not there, but also just giving the feeling of vastness to the whole empire when you're stuck in a ship for 12 days, which is quite a small environment. I still wanted it to feel vast. Yeah, I'm not really a map person usually, but I had to draw it for this to make sense of it in my mind. And I knew that readers would need that visual too. Without getting into too much of the plot, there's an element of the plot where it's really helpful to know what the empire looks like, which is a big triangle.
And the politics of it, because there's certain provinces who mean like they crap, right? And there's certain provinces who are high up on the, you know, on the echelon of how they stand and how much they contribute. And then there's people who are like, oh, they're just from Snake Province, it doesn't really matter. Or they're from Fish Province, they don't really matter. So when you sat down and you were like, okay, this particular province is going to be responsible for this in terms of feeding the whole of Concordia, or they responsible for protecting these people. So all of that, I like what you said earlier about you only included what was relevant to the plot, because I think the problem with people who write fantasy and who do world building is you can geek out so much that you include things that aren't important. So what you said there is so important. So only include the world building elements that are really important to furthering the plot. So in the ship, I mean, you've pretty much got a closed room murder mystery because it's in the ship and people start dying. And certain provinces have got more sway because they're in charge of the resources. And so everybody wants those resources. So they're fighting for those resources. So that gives people means, motives, sort of opportunity, because they want those resources. So were you coming up with things originally and saying, okay, that doesn't serve the plot, so that's going to be taken out. This has to be in there because it serves the plot. I'm trying to figure out for readers how they know what world building components are essential and what is just peripheral and just something you find interesting but may not be something the reader needs to know.
Yeah, that's tricky to know, because obviously we love our world building and we want to put as much in as possible. There are little things that I put in that are just like fun things that aren't necessarily direct plot things to help, you know, visualize it a bit more. But yeah, it definitely helps to just put in the bits that are relevant to the plot. I would say I put more in to begin with, and it was a matter of editing it down once I came to it, because it was quite chunky. After I've added all the stuff in about all the characters and all the world building, I had to be quite merciless and go, what is this telling us and how does this link to anything that we need to know for the sake of the murder mystery plot?
Let's talk about working with a huge cast, because this is always the most difficult part of a book, is especially in a murder mystery. You need enough people to be murdered so that it leaves enough suspects, right? You need enough cast so that there's enough red herrings and that the reader is like, oh, I'm sure it's this person. And then when they die, they're like, oh shit, it wasn't this person. Back to the drawing board, maybe it's this person. But you can't have so many that the reader ends up confused. And the reader needs to know very clearly in their mind who everyone is, where they're from, what their motives are, what their province is responsible for. And the excellent thing is you don't reveal upfront what everyone's blessings are. So we don't know upfront what superpowers each of these people have, which could therefore help them in terms of the murder. So we keep reading to find these things out. So again, what's your advice when it comes to balancing such a huge cast, but keeping it very clear in the reader's mind who everyone is?
Yeah, that was a big challenge for this book. And especially, I would say chapter two was my most difficult chapter to write, because basically it introduced everybody apart from the main character, who we already know from chapter one. There's 11 characters introduced in one chapter. And these are, you know, all from places we don't know. So we're getting introduced to the places and the people at the same time. And yeah, that was definitely the hardest chapter of the book. I tried to give each character, just to begin with, very key signifiers of who they were. Several of them, actually. So if people didn't remember everything, they could be like, oh, it's that guy. So that party, for instance, was a costume party, deliberately, so they could dress up like the animal. So we would associate them with the animal of the province they're from, the sigil animal. Also, other characters have... This is also fun, that they all have different coloured hair. But it also helps with telling who's who, because in my head, I saw it as like Cluedo pieces. I think you call it Clue, with the, they're all different colors. So in my head, I was moving Cluedo pieces.
South Africans also call it Cluedo. So I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. So having them look so very different, right?
Yeah. Look so very different. They're all quite different in personality as well. And some of them are quite similar to the animals. At the start, it really was just associating them on a basic level. And until we could get one-on-one with the main character, we could get a bit deeper. He's also very opinionated about them, so he could give quite a lot in his narration to remind them by. Yeah, some of them he's fond of, and some of them he's definitely not fond of, so his narration helped a lot with that as well. But if I had a choice, I wouldn't introduce them all in one chapter. I didn't have a choice. My advice would be not to do that if you can avoid it, because then the people will stick out more to you. But when you have no choice, you've got to just try and get very key aspects of them down before you try and get a bit deeper.
Yeah, it is so tough to do. For our listeners, we generally say don't do that. Don't introduce the reader to so many characters at once. But if you are going to do it and you have to do it, you have got to read Frances's book so you can see how she did it. Because when somebody does it incredibly well, they make it look so easy. And so you go, well, she did it. I'm able to do it, until you start doing it yourself. And then you're like, okay, that wasn't as simple as I thought. Something as well that you did so brilliantly was... you had a lot of representation of different groups here, which I absolutely loved, because representation really matters. And sometimes you'll have readers who absolutely love that. And sometimes you'll have readers who are like, oh, these are just token characters. But I'm always like, representation matters. And even if they're a peripheral character, having them on the page is important. And I know that you got sensitivity readers or authenticity readers to make sure that you were doing that respectfully and authentically. So can you speak a bit about that process as well and why it was so important to you?
Yeah, so when I went in, I was focusing on, obviously I've said before, about making it feel like an empire. And to me, an empire is very varied, lots of different cultures into a melting pot, and I really wanted it to feel that way. It also helped with distinguishing them. It all helps towards it, but for me, I come from a very diverse city. It would be very weird for me to just have a novel that just has straight white characters. That's not the world that I know. The world that I know is full of lots of different people with lots of different... And I don't see it as token. I just see it as people existing. And it doesn't have to be part of the plot. It doesn't have to be relevant at all. In fact, I prefer that as representation, when it's not part of the plot, when it's, oh, he happens to be... our main character happens to be bisexual and he happens to be chubby, but the story isn't about that. I think that sort of normalizes it in a way for people who aren't from that sort of background. But yeah, so the... sensitivity readers, that was, my publisher paid for that, which was quite good. Obviously, my book has so many different, we couldn't cover every single thing. Luckily, I cover a few myself, and so do my beta readers. But we got someone in who was able to look at the black characters and some of the queer rep, which I don't share. And she read it all. She gave a report on anything that stood out to her as a little bit iffy, but mostly it was positive. But I was able to address the few points, the things I wasn't aware of that I was doing.
Well, and I think it will be positive, because I always say it depends on our intention when we go into this. And I feel like when we go into it, wanting to handle it respectfully, and we're doing it from a place of, like you say, you know, not tokenism, but just wanting to reflect your reality. And you have beta readers who, you know, who come from these different groups who are able to give you that feedback, then I think your intention is going to come out on the page. But it is still important to get those authenticity and sensitivity readers, certainly. Can I ask, I mean, our time is running out. I could pick your brain all day, Frances, really, but I'm trying to get to the things that I know our listeners are going to be especially interested in. When you pitched this, I forgot to ask, what did you comp it to? Because, you know, having a murder mystery that's also fantasy is unusual. We're seeing more of them now, but certainly when you sold this book like 2 years ago or however long before it came out, what were your comps?
So obviously I didn't query it, so I didn't have to think of query comps, but we struggled a lot when it went on sub with comps. My agent, I'd had a discussion with my agent about it, and he spoke to the US agent who was standing out in the US. The only comparison title that I could think of was Gideon the Ninth, because that also has a sort of voiciness to it, and it's a locked room kind of murder mystery-ish sort of feel. And I felt like readers of that would also enjoy that. But that was the only comp that we had for the book when it went on sub, because there was nothing else, nothing that was recent, I would say. But my publisher, I think the rules are different for publishers, because they just ran with like Agatha Christie, which is Agatha Christie but magic, Agatha Christie but fantasy. They said a little bit of Hunger Games in there as well. So it was older comps, but there isn't really a great comp for it, which is, yeah, a bit stressful. But
you're a trailblazer, because then you blaze the way for the rest of us, because I've written a murder mystery that's also fantasy. And I was like, oh, what the hell am I going to comp it to? And then my editor, who I think we share, Nicole Brebner, was like, oh my God, you have to read this book. And then I read it. I was like, oh my God, I love this book. And it's so great that I have something to kind of comp it to. But yeah, we need the trailblazers like you who go ahead and forge new paths for the rest of us. When you were writing this, was it ever a toss-up for you in terms of saying, is this YA, is it adult? Or was it a case of this is going to be a genre melding blend? Because I feel like this is the kind of book, I love it, but I know my niece is going to love it. I'm like, you need to read this book. And she's 16 and I know she's absolutely going to love it. We've got the cussing, we've got the F-bombs, we've got, you know, the very adult themes in here. But it's wonderful that it's a genre blend. Was it ever a toss-up for you, or were you like, no, this is adult, and if YA like it, then that's also cool?
The very early stages, it was planned to be a YA, because I think I was like at the peak of, oh, I'm giving up on adult, let me go for YA. But as I started to develop the characters, I was like, no, it doesn't quite work. I think they need to be older. And I felt a little bit constrained in the YA box, because I've not written it before and I felt a bit more pressure of the expectations of that genre. So I went back into adult and I let myself swear all I wanted to and put everything in. But I was aware that it would probably be a crossover. We pitched it that way, YA crossover potential. And one of my youngest readers, who's such a big fan, is 11, which I was like, oh gosh. But yeah, I guess you can enjoy it no matter what age you are. And I see some people say it's YA, and I think maybe that's because it's quite fun. And people forget that adult fantasy could also be fun. We can enjoy ourselves. It can be entertaining as well. Doesn't necessarily mean it's YA. I don't really mind what people call it, to be honest with you, as long as they enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, it hits that sweet spot. That is what publishers are always talking about. There's a sweet spot. Like, adults are going to love it. Younger readers are going to love it. I mean, kids see far worse on television these days. You know, this child who's 11 who read your book did not learn the cuss words from your book. I can promise you that. So, yeah. So I want to talk about Ganymedes and the voiciness of this narration. I mean, he is hilarious. He's just so wonderfully vulnerable. He's got this soft core. He's just the kind of character you want to spend this many pages with. And voiciness is so difficult to articulate to writers when we say we want a voiciness. For our listeners who are like, what is voiciness? Get this book. By page 3, I'm killing myself laughing at the way Ganymedes sees the world, at the way he describes the world. It's just that voiciness was there. So is that a lot of your voice that just came through? You were like, I'm just going to allow myself to be Frances, and Ganymedes and I are so similar in terms of the voiciness? Or was it a case of you sit down and you have to really channel him before you begin writing so that you can capture that voiciness?
I would say a little bit of both. I've told this story a few times, but he wasn't the original main character. He was a side character. but he sort of like captured my attention. He was just more interesting, and he's not the usual protagonist that I'd written up till that point. He's way more louder with no filter, says what he's got to say, and who cares what everybody thinks. But I think I knew he should be the main character when I did try and write a little bit in his voice and it just poured out. I know that's so unhelpful to say, oh, it just happened, but it did with him. And I do think there is a bit of me in it, but me with less filter. If I was just saying what I wanted to say. But there is a bit of getting into his mindset for sure. I would say all characters have a little bit of you, main characters at least. It kind of naturally bleeds into them, especially with him. His insecurities are a lot of my insecurities. We share that much, but he is me if I just didn't care what people thought and just said whatever. So I guess it was kind of freeing to write him in that way.
Yeah, he's like the me I want to be. And for our listeners, I want to tell you how important a first paragraph is, because you're setting up the tone, you're setting up what is to come, you're setting expectations. And this paragraph just perfectly encapsulates this book. So it goes, my father always says you can't run from your responsibilities, but he lacks imagination. Besides, I'm not running, I'm sidestepping, crossing the road so me and my responsibilities don't make eye contact and aren't forced into awkward small talk both of us know isn't going anywhere. And that immediately had me chuckling. It immediately gave me insight into the kind of character I was going to spend time with. Was that always your opening paragraph, Frances, or was that something that took some revision to really nail it?
That was always the opening. From the very beginning, that never changed. A little bit of the wording changed, but I wanted to nail the kind of person he was in the first sentence, and I guess the first paragraph, of just someone who doesn't want anything to do with their responsibilities, a little bit cheeky. Yeah, I think you just get the vibes instantly from that, and I think it contrasts well with the ending. I like doing that, taking the beginning and the ending and showing the character's journey that way.
Yeah, well, we can't talk about the ending because of spoilers, but yes. Okay, Frances, this has been an absolute delight. For our listeners, we are linking to Voyage of the Damned on our bookshop.org affiliate page. You get the book there, you support an independent bookstore, you support the podcast, and like I say, get this hardcover. I'm not usually a fan of hardcovers. They tend to smack me on the noggin when I fall asleep while I'm reading. I've ended up with a bruise on my face before from a hardcover, but this is a hardcover you want. I promise you, this is like a collector's item you absolutely want. And Frances, we look so forward to seeing what you come out with next.
Thank you. It's been so lovely to speak to you.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the 3rd day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
The best thing about writing? Anything can happen. You get to build a world from scratch and fill it with daring heroes and epic tales of good and evil. The worst thing about writing? Anything can happen. Where do you even start when literally anything is possible? How about a deck with more than 30 billion writing or world-building prompts? The Story Engine deck and Deck of Worlds are a great way to fire up your imagination. Create a new character with fun quirks and daring motivations in less than 60 seconds with the Story Engine. With Deck of Worlds, build entire civilizations with distinct foods, customs, and history, and set the plot in motion with world-shaking conflicts for your characters to overcome. It's time to write your next bestseller. Our decks give you the tools to tell the story you want to tell. Visit storyenginedeck.com and use promo code AboutWriting10 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order from now until September 30th. That's AboutWriting10. Slay your writer's block and get excited to sit down at your desk every day. Go to storyenginedeck.com and pick up the Story Engine Deck in Deck of Worlds.